Oh, please turn to Psalm 33 again, page 463. There are various years that people remember. 2012, London Olympics. 1976 was a hot summer, which some of you, most of you, are perhaps too young to really remember, but some of us can. But people are certainly going to remember the summer of 2018. Football may or may not be coming home, but with the heat that is so unusual over such a sustained period at such temperatures and the World Cup, this is going to be a memorable summer. Lots of celebration. I guess there are people who aren't that interested in the football, but even most of them have got some idea about it. And if you listen to the media, then everyone is happy and excited and thrilled at Gareth Southgate's boys doing much better than expected. But what are we going to do when the summer of 2018 is over, when the party's over? There was a huge party in Soho last night because it was the annual Pride celebration, the march and then the boozing and so on afterwards. And if you walk through the streets of Soho late last night, early this morning, well, the party wasn't quite over perhaps, but the debris that was littered around, piles and piles of rubbish strewing the streets. Not just rubbish, huge pile of vomit outside someone's front door. Bodies lying around, never mind the ones that were still standing. And worse, I guess the football didn't help. But the hangover from that, not just the too much drinking, but the outcome of that, well, it could be pretty miserable. And sometimes when you live where I do, it seems like we need to have one continuous party. There always needs to be something going on in central London to make people happy, to give people a chance to enjoy themselves. Today I think Regent Street is closed so that you can walk down it traffic free. Only there are so many people there, it's not much fun to walk down, I would imagine. Who knows? There'll be all sorts of stuff going on. But every weekend, and very often during the week too, something special has to happen. And when you stop to think about it, our ordinary lives are a bit like that, aren't they? We live for special things, it seems. So for some of us who are interested in football, yep, the World Cup is a big, big thing and we've been looking forward to it for a while. But we look forward to other things. We look forward to birthdays. We particularly look forward to holidays. We trudge through the week to get to the weekend. Well, here's the thing. For Christians, the party is never over. We don't have to look for the next fix. We don't have to look for the next celebration because we always have God, our God, and he's with us. And we gather each week to worship him together, but there's no reason why that worship can't overflow into every day. And the psalmist in Psalm 33 wants to encourage us, particularly together, to worship God. But surely we can take away that worship into our everyday lives. So, first of all, the psalmist points us to the exciting, thrilling word and work of God. This psalm is a real challenge for you if you came to church this morning rather uninspired. And let's be honest, that happens, doesn't it? We're not always full of the joys at spring at the thought, oh, it's Sunday, brilliant, let's go to church and worship. There are different reasons for that. Perhaps, thank you, John, perhaps we are wearied from the week. Perhaps there is a particular thing that is really weighing our hearts down. Perhaps we've been distracted by the football or whatever it might be. But if you did come to church sort of uninspired, unenthusiastic, well, this psalm is a real challenge because it calls for a lively response to God, not just sitting there. Shout for joy in the Lord, you righteous. We don't have a lyre, we don't have a harp, we have a piano, we have a guitar, we have our voices. Sing to him a new song, play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. I guess one of the things the psalmist is saying to us is that the joy of football fans shouldn't exceed the joy of believers. We may not clap in quite the same rhythm, we may not sing quite the same tunes, but when we come to set our hearts and our minds on God, then there should be life and energy and joy at the centre of what we do. And with good reason. Verses 4 and 5 of the psalm give us a glimpse of the character of God, the character of his word and his work. You see, the word of the Lord is upright. It's straight, it's true, it's utterly reliable. All his work is done in faithfulness. You can depend on God. We live in a world where so much is not straight, not upright, it's crooked, twisted, distorted, broken. We live in a world where so much is uncertain and fickle, changeable. Not God. You can rely on God. You can trust God. Verse 5, he loves righteousness and justice. Things that deep down each one of us is crying out for. I didn't actually see it, but I gather there was a really unusual episode of EastEnders this week. There's been a storyline going on in which a young boy's been stabbed and killed. And I think it was his funeral during one of the programmes this week. And alongside the actors acting out a story, there were real people mourning real loved ones who'd been really stabbed to death to draw attention to the reality, the horror of knife crime. And those people were crying out for righteousness and justice. Righteousness so that knife crime doesn't take place, so that one young kid doesn't stab another young kid. And justice, if it does happen, then we don't just let it go. And God is a God of righteousness and justice. Indeed, the psalmist tells us the earth is full of his steadfast love. God's unshakable love for people like us is throughout the world. And we don't always feel as if that's true. And often we don't bother to think about it. But when we do, we should become joyful worshippers of God. This is Israel's God. This is Yahweh. You'll see that the word Lord is in capital letters, and that's what it means. It's taking that name of God that was especially given to Moses for Israel. This is the sign, the symbol of the relationship between God and his chosen people. We'll come back to that in a moment. But the word and the work of God is exciting. And there's more. So we go into verses 6, 7, 8, 9, and we discover that this God is the creator of everything. Well, we discover it. We know that, don't we? We know that's the Bible's teaching, and most of the time, it's just in our heads. But the psalmist is telling us, no, think about it and worship. Think about it and rejoice. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. By the breath of his mouth, all our hosts. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. We experience awe in different sorts of ways in our human life. If you want to stick with football, I remember seeing Kenny Dalglish score a goal for Liverpool against Ipswich. And the way he scored it, you just went, wow. And that sort of thing happens pretty often in top-level football. There's a big difference between seeing something on the television as well and seeing it live. A relatively unknown footballer, especially these days, was a Scottish player called Mark McGee, who played for Aberdeen. I can remember seeing him for the first time, close up. I was in the stand and he was, well, roughly where Sammy was. And he controlled the ball and it stuck to his foot in a way. I was like, whew, never happens with me. Harry Kane, did you see him take that penalty last week? All that pressure, thump, no question, is going in. But there are all sorts of other things. Buildings can create a sense of awe. I mean, you see St. Paul's Cathedral from Fleet Street and you think, oh, that's quite impressive. You get up close to it and you think, oh, how on earth did they do that? And that's just the outside. Psalmist is telling us we need to be in awe of God. That's another level completely. This goes way beyond the sort of things that we limit ourselves to. Things that human beings do, things that human beings have made. But this is the God who spoke the vastness of creation into being. The extent of it, the heavens, the host of the heavens, the stars, the planets, but also the minutest detail of it, spoken into God. Sorry, spoken into being by God. That sea that Paul was floating around in. Don't you sometimes see you're standing on the, perhaps on the cliff on a little bit, and you look down at a bay and you sort of think, just imagine trying to sort of gather up the waters of that one little bay in it's overwhelming. You can't do it. It's impossible. And then you think, this is just such a tiny part of this planet. And God spoke it into being. And we should be in awe of a God like that. And we should rejoice that there is a God like that. But the psalmist goes on to tell us he's the ruler of what he's made. Verses 10 and 11. All these people who cover the earth. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. The plans of his heart to all generations. So Donald Trump is coming to London. What good will it do? What harm will it do? Well, we have no idea. He's in those discussions with North Korea. Are they going to be positive or are they going to turn out to be nothing much? He's in a battle with China over trade tariffs. What's going to happen with that situation? And have we all forgotten about the Middle East and the various other problems in the world just because there's a World Cup? No, life goes on. And what can we do about it? Well, nothing, more or less. And what about the great human beings of the past, the great leaders, the glorious leaders of the past? Where are they now? All those empires. Oh, history is a fascinating thing, but it's in the past. Where's Napoleon? Where's Julius Caesar? Where's Hitler? Whereas God is the God of history who controls all of that. God is the God who has had his plan for history from before the beginning. And that plan is centered on, well, yes, us human beings, the people who he's made, but in particular, it's centered on one man, his son, Jesus Christ. And that plan of salvation is the only plan that will last, and it will last until it's been completed. Oh, the greatest of men can plan all sorts of stuff, but it will come to nothing. God's plan will be fulfilled. And here's a really encouraging thought this morning, that everybody who sets themselves against God and against his plan will be frustrated. It's a really tough thing as a Christian to walk the streets of Soho during Pride. Not everybody there is consciously set against the God of heaven. Many of them are. But the very celebration speaks against God. Pride, the name of it. Well, the pride of man set against the glory of God. No, we don't celebrate pride in ourselves. We rejoice in the God of heaven, the God of creation, the God who rules over history, the God of steadfast love, the God who is full of righteousness and justice. And when you walk through the streets of London in a situation like that, or indeed on any average day through the West End, what is the great God of the West End? Well, business, money. That sort of godlessness is grievous. It can touch your heart. Oh, sometimes we can hardly even notice it. But when you think about it, isn't it sad that we're focused on these things in this way against God? But that sadness, that grief is not a reason to be gloomy. It's not as if we're doomed, as if goodness is going to be overwhelmed forever by the tide of godlessness. No, the psalmist tells us it's the counsel of the Lord that stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. You can't stop God. And if we're on his side, then we're on the side that will be victorious, that will overcome. So the psalmist sees God and his word and his work as something that's really thrilling. Shout for joy in the Lord because of these things. Now, it's true, it's not always easy to see that. We do need faith. That's why this morning we go back to his word. Each Sunday we go back to his word, just as we were singing in our last hymn. We need to believe these things. We need to trust God because we don't always see it like that. It doesn't always appear to be as if God is in control and is reigning over all things. But it's the truth, it's the reality. From verses 12 through to 19, we see the people on this planet are divided into two. Yes, God rules over all of them. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of man, verse 13 tells us. But we discover that God has chosen a people in verse 12. Men try to do all sorts of stuff, but God frustrates the plans of men. His plans are the ones that will be fulfilled. Verse 12, and blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he's chosen as his heritage. In the Old Testament, that people was Israel. With the coming of Jesus, that nation is the people of God, the church. These are the people who are like God in some way. There's an affinity. Look at verse 1. Who are the people who are celebrating God? Who are the people who are rejoicing? Well, the righteous and the upright. Those who share something of their Father in heaven's character. Because in verse 4, we discover that the word of the Lord is upright. In verse 5, we discover that righteousness is something that God loves. It's part of his character. It's who he is. And his people are like him. Well, not exactly like him, of course. But the wonderful truth is that Jesus has brought us into God's family and begins to make that likeness in us. We're connected. And so God sees the nations and he sees the nation. the nations of the world, everybody. Well, God sees all of them. He looks down on all of those. He brings their counsels, their plans to nothing. But there is one nation, the people of God who are blessed. There's a difference between them and us. And a big question this morning for each of us is, well, who do we belong to? Who is them? Who is us? Where do you belong? And we get a picture of the two sorts of people, the nations and the nation. First of all, verse 16 and verse 17. There are people who struggle to cope with life. Now, that coping might look very grand in human terms. The psalmist speaks of a king, of a great army. He speaks of a warrior, a war horse. These are mighty powerful things, they seem to us. Sounds great. They don't sound like they're struggling to cope with life, but think about it. Yeah, they are. They're fighting, they're battling, they're warring. They are taking their own destiny into their own hands and seeking to achieve what they want. And the psalmist tells us, it's not going to happen. You can't do it. They, these great mighty forces, can't control their own fate. And the reality is that nor can we. However much energy and effort we expend in seeking to struggle to cope with our own lives, whether we've got grand ambitions or whether we really are struggling near the bottom of the pile somewhere, but when we try to do that with our own strength, we are doomed to failure. And the greatest failure of all, well, that's mentioned in verse 19, it's the failure of death. Who can stop death in its tracks? Who can make themselves immortal? The king, the warrior, the war horse, well, salvation isn't going to come through them. Salvation, in earthly terms, may well seem to come for a while at least, but empires come and empires go. But salvation from death is just not going to happen. It can't be done. Oh, we think we can cope with life. We try to put off the idea of death. We think we have to cope with life, don't we? We think we must do it by ourselves. But there is an alternative. The psalmist presents those who struggle to cope with life on their own as doomed, but there is an alternative. And the alternative is to depend on God. Verses 18 and 19. You can either have DIY, do it yourself, or DOG, not dog, depend on God. That's the way you can live your life. What do you focus on? Do you focus on yourself and your own life situation and the things that you need to do to try to make it work out for the best? Or do you focus on God? The classic illustration of that from the Bible is the story of Peter in the boat with other disciples, and Jesus comes walking on the water and tells Peter to come to him. And Peter steps onto the water. Woo-hoo! But he doesn't just breeze across the water to Jesus, because he looks at the waves, he feels the wind, and he begins to go under. I have a friend who struggles to cope with life, who works really quite hard at trying to cope with his life. All sorts of things in his background make that difficult. And every so often he'll come and talk to me about it. And I will say, look, the only real way I know to help you from where you are is through God. It's through the Lord Jesus. In effect, I'm telling him the same things the psalmist is telling us. You can try to cope with life on your own. You can struggle away and do this, that and the other and try and sort it out. Or you can focus on God. You can fear him. You can trust in his love. And his answer is, I can't deal with that at the moment. That religious stuff, that God stuff. I just want you to listen to where I am and give me some advice. And that's so hard. Because any advice I give him is so limited in its effect. It isn't going to change the fundamental problems that he's facing. Whereas God can, and God does, and for many of us, we know that as a reality, which is a reason to rejoice and to thank him and to worship him. You see, God sees everybody. But he sees those of us who focus on God in a different way. Verse 18, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him. The eye of the Lord, God is watching over to protect, to preserve, to sustain, to keep. This is the goodness of God, the steadfast love of God in action. And the Bible and the history of Christian believers since bears testimony to this wonderful love and faithfulness of God. God who keeps his people in the most extreme of situations. Now, some of us have faced pretty extreme situations in our lives, pretty painful things to bear. But the Bible and Christian history can show us people who've borne greater burdens than we ever have, who have still been able to testify to the goodness of God, to the love of God, the reality of God. And more than anything else, we see this salvation, of course, in Jesus and in the cross. God's love shown to us by sending his Son into our world to live a holy, pure, perfect life of obedience. And to die that death that is really inexplicable in human terms. But God loved us and wanted to save us and put that plan into action. And that plan is continuing even today. Where do you belong in this picture that the psalmist gives for us? Are you one of those people who's struggling to sort life out yourself? Or have you come to see God and his love? And have you given up your own control, your own attempt to rule your own life? And submitted to him and trusted him and accepted the gift of salvation through Jesus. You see, the psalmist wants us to sing a new song to the Lord. That's a common theme in the psalm, or it appears at least more than once for sure. This is a psalm that isn't related to a particular incident, a particular event. Some of the psalms have a little heading that tells you what caused this psalm to be written. Psalm 33, no idea, it's a general psalm. And the reason is that it's always applicable to the people of God at any time, in any age. God's love is real. That's what the psalmist wants to tell us, to remind us. We should rejoice in that. And so we need to make that love of God, that steadfast love of God, part of our experience, a fresh part of our experience, something that's new every morning. So that when we come to worship God together, our hearts are full, we are happy, we are overflowing with joy in the Lord. And we can worship him with life and energy and enthusiasm. It's not always easy to do that. Sometimes it can be really tough. We do face all sorts of things. Things in our own lives, things in the lives of people we love. Situations that are really hard. But the end of the psalm tells us how we're to face those things. We're to wait for the Lord. Waiting on God is hard. It's not natural to us. We are restless. We want to do it ourselves. But trust God. We find all sorts of reasons to try and do things and work our own way, to work things out ourselves. And sometimes we even think, perhaps even say, God doesn't love me. How can God love me when this is happening? When this loved one is dying, when I'm suffering this, when I'm going through that, when I can't seem to make any headway in life. How does God love me? And some of us need to be aware of our own temperaments. Some of us find it so easy to forget the good things in life, the blessings of God. So easy to focus on the bad things in life. It's not fair. And the psalmist tells us this morning, don't be a victim. Don't just look so inwardly that you miss the big picture of God's steadfast love in creation, in history, in Christ. God's love for you. Don't miss it. And when you see it, well, even if life is hard in many different ways, at the same time, it is possible to rejoice. Paul encourages the Philippian Christians to rejoice in all circumstances. And we can really do that as believers this morning. If we trust God for who he is. If we confidently put our hope in what he has promised. If we look forward to what is come, what is to come. If we experience his love now. Because we are walking with him. We are bringing our burdens to him. We are looking for his help in our everyday reality, not trying to work it out ourselves. And those things are really just a taste of what is to come when the Lord returns. When, if you like, order is restored. When life becomes what God has always intended it to be. For Christians, the party never needs to be over, because God is always the same. God is always with us. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart is glad in him, because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. We've every reason to be glad. Let's put that into practice as we